Start now.
This is a conversation with Mr. Andy Moore. With Mr. Andy Young in Atlanta, Georgia, March 17. Do you remember how or when your present views and attitudes toward active participation in civil rights and racial matters began, Mr. Young?
Well, I guess it's something that comes, as you said before, implied from childhood. I grew up in New Orleans, and well, my father was a dentist. But we lived in a neighborhood where there were very few Negro families. In fact, we were, for a long time, we were about the only children in the neighborhood, and the neighborhood was largely white. And yet, my folks were the only professional people in the neighborhood. It was a lower income neighborhood where my father had a dental office. And I think very early in life, I ran into both the problems of race and class.
How was his clientele? Were his patients part of white and part of Negro?
Yeah, interestingly enough, they were. They were largely Negro, but at times they were up to close to a fifth of his practice was white, and yet you had a strange kind of social dynamic there, in that financially we were a little better off than the whites in the neighborhood, and they were prejudiced against us because of race. My parents had certain class notions against them and against the Negroes that moved in the neighborhood, so that almost from the time that I was able to get out in the streets by myself, say at 6 or 7 years old, I was caught in this kind of dilemma. And I think I decided then that that people were people, and that these external categories of economics and race were little or no significance, and I was almost always getting spanked by my parents for playing with the wrong kids. And at the same time, I think the children in the neighborhood, the white children in the neighborhood, were being spanked by their parents for playing with us. Our yard, our backyard. I think Negro parents in the South try to compensate for segregation by really giving their children all the things that they wanted to have, so that we had basketball goals, swings, wading pools, all of this kind of thing, and in our yard. And we always had the football and the baseball and this sort of thing. And the kids coming into the yard, my mother was always a little reticent about the kind of people that we brought in to play with us. And we insisted, my younger brother and I, almost always on choosing our own friends. And if it came time to have lunch and there weren't too many people there, especially since many of the kids, we knew that both parents were working and they didn't have any arrangements for lunch, we would insist on mother fixing lunch for everybody that was there. Now, this was, I think, the first thing. But then, too, I began to realize as I got a little older that my parents got their education as a result of somebody else's missionary activity and concern. They went to what was then Straight College in New Orleans, and they were the products of... excuse me.
You were speaking of your parents and Straight College.
Yeah, and almost all of their education came and they talked very affectionately about the people from New England that came down and provided an education for them. And it always seemed to me that that the middle-class Negro community in New Orleans that had derived its status from somebody else's sacrifice was doing too little itself. So that...
This struck you.
Yeah. That Yeah, now...
Speaking of sacrifice...
They were... well, for instance, most of their friends were professional people, doctors, lawyers, all of them doing quite well. Most of them in that stage were just beginning to enjoy the affluent life. And they seemed to have no concern for the masses of people in New Orleans. And I remember an incident where, I guess I was in high school then, where the Flint Goodrich Hospital needed some money. Now, most of the doctors and several of the dentists worked there and made most of their money there. And yet they depended almost solely on Northern contributions.
That's a segregated Negro hospital, right?
Yeah, it was a segregated Negro hospital. They didn't seem to feel any sense of responsibility, I think. And this always bothered me, that people should I don't know where I got this notion from, that if something's given to you, you have a responsibility to share it and pass it on.
I understand by reading and by conversation that there is still a great lag between the Negro wealth and Negro philanthropy or Negro gifts to actual to other forms of good works, including civil rights.
Well, this is very true. These people, for instance, still would give very little, if anything, to any civil rights movement or civil rights organization. They would probably now, just in a matter of obligation, take out a small membership to the NAACP and give $10, $20 a year, whereas many of them are in the $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year income bracket. So this, I think it was in the Negro community that I began to get sensitive. Now, part of this was because my parents didn't really let me come in contact with the harshness of segregation in New Orleans. They did everything possible to protect me from any kind of harmful incident. So I can't really, I didn't get any of the bitter experiences in childhood, I think, that many Negroes get. Still, it was all around you.
Yes. Some people, such as Mr. Farmer, have said, and he's written this, that segregation actually, in his case, worked as a spur, as a stimulus to achievement. Mm-hmm. And this is occasionally said. This is no argument for segregation, but...
No. But I don't think this was the case with me at all. In fact, I always resisted this. I always wanted to be myself, and my folks used to try to tell me, you're a Negro and you can't be just as good as a white person, you've got to be better. And this was supposed to be an incentive to study. And yet I never studied. I did a lot of reading on my own, but just in terms of achievement, in terms of grades. And when my first integrated school experience was in seminary, in Connecticut, Hartford Seminary.
Yes.
And I can remember being very determined by that time that I had no burden of a race to carry, that I was going to learn what I wanted to learn and do what I wanted to do, and if I had great questions about education in general, and I was going to see that I got the kind of education I wanted. If I didn't get A's, it didn't bother me.
Have you read lately the controversy between Irving Howe and Ralph Ellison that involves this point?
No, I haven't. And,
it's quite interesting. It's, mm-hmm. it's Ralph's attitude, too, you see. He yeah. refuses to be put in the position of the traitor to the Negro because he is not an activist, or because he wants to be a writer rather than mm-hmm. a sign carrier.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. He, in fact, calls Irving Howe another kind of Bilbo. You want to put him in his place.
Yeah.
The Irving Howe's an expert. Mm-hmm. That argument, yeah. you see. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get off the point, though.
No. Mm-hmm. But I think that that I never really knew what I wanted to do. My folks tried to mold me into their professional pattern, and I rebelled against the black bourgeois value system almost from as far back as I can remember. And it was really almost after I got through college at Howard University that I finally began to shape some value structure of my own and choose a direction. I think it first came out as a desire to work in Africa in some way. And then, yet I went south to pastor a little church in Alabama, met my wife, and she was concerned about staying in the South. This was my first experience in the rural South. Her mother had taught in a one-room schoolhouse most of her life, and her mother was one of these exceptionally, really brilliant women that was completely self-educated, practically. I remember we went to Europe, and her mother, just a small town, 3,000 Alabama one-room school teacher, sat down without looking at a note or a book or anything, looked at our itinerary, where we were going, and just listed off the places that we should be sure to see, and which museums certain art objects were, and somehow she'd acquired a real general education and dedication to education. And my wife picked this up, and so it was her desire to work in the South. And this is where I think I began to switch in terms of working here.
Let me put a question this way.
Mm-hmm.
You remember in reading Du Bois, and he talks long ago about the split in the Negro psyche, or the possible split, at least for some people. On one hand, the impulse to draw toward an African mystique of some kind, a sense of a Negro tradition, a Negro culture, the Negro folk sense, and blood sense.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the pull toward Western European, Judeo-Christian, American society and values, with a pull to integrate and perhaps be totally absorbed, even by blood, in that world in the end. This being, by some people, taken as treason to a deeper obligation. Has this ever been a problem for you when you think of
Always.
Africa?
Yeah.
That's a real
Always.
Problem.
And
does it remain a problem?
Yeah, I think. In fact, I think it's being pretty nearly. I'm just getting to the point where I'm beginning to be able to resolve it a little bit. But for instance, when I got to seminary, I think I did a lot of work in anthropology, mainly with this in mind. Now, with me, it came from my folks were the assimilationists. They didn't like spirituals. No blues, anything Negroid they shied away from. So it started in rebellion against this because my friends, rock and roll hit the Negro community a good 10, 20 years while it was always in some form. So that this is where we first began to have the clash when I began to choose, in grammar school, they sent me to all of the New Orleans Symphony children's concerts on Saturday. I was expected to do all of this kind of thing and enjoyed it, learned a lot from it. But when I also wanted to go, began to buy the rock and roll blues records, they somehow said that this was cheap and I shouldn't bother with this. Well, we fought over that score and I won out. I think that that's where I began to experience a conflict. Now, I haven't, I don't know whether I can articulate it, but this is one of the things that you say what you really want to do. I think that one of these days when I get around to writing something, this is one of the things that I'd like to experiment with and try to put down in some way, or try to get organized for myself. I take an analogy of out of my experiences with the work of the churches, that the various denominations really tend to enrich religious life, because each one came into being around a witness to a specific religious insight. Now, I think you lose something when you just kind of water down and get a least common denominator religious experience, that you get a much deeper religious experience when you begin to appreciate the contributions of these different denominational bodies. Now, I think of the same thing in terms of cultural traditions, that the Negro cultural experience is real, and it represents an authentic attempt to cope with what their existence was at the time.
Even in America now.
Yeah, in America.
Negro cultural experience.
That's right.
In America.
And this is, I think that well, the concept of family life that was derived under segregation necessarily had to be stronger. I think this is what Raisin in the Sun, Lorraine Hansberry, was trying to bring out in the mother that Claudia McNeil played.
But it's a matriarchal world, isn't it?
Yeah. But that in bringing this, that I don't know that, well, you relate this to the white South, where women were put on a pedestal and had almost no power, no role in family, no strong role. And I would say I don't want to throw out this strong matriarchy and accept the American middle road. That I think that the pressures of 20th century life demand a strong matriarchy, but they also demand a man who is able to, in spite of the strength of the feminine figure, is able to maintain the at least some equality. That the real equality of the sexes in America is possibly more possible under the Negro's experience now.
I know a psychiatrist, a Negro psychiatrist and analyst in Connecticut, who has said to me that this represents, in one sense, the Negro Revolution, the Negro Revolt,
mm-hmm.
an affirmation of the male principle after the
mm-hmm.
hundreds of years of matriarchy.
Well, a man
now,
has
man,
to.
A man's
yeah.
business.
Mm-hmm. And a man has to. Has to change the society. Women can maintain and strengthen, but the protest role, the role of shaping a world, the creative role in a social and political sense, I think is the man's. And I think that the movement is giving men an opportunity to really exercise this and find themselves.
In this sense, then, the general movement corresponds to the black Muslim principle on that one point.
Yeah, I'd say that the black Muslims, because the black Muslims are trying to transplant something, a male dominance from the East.
Yes, the motive is different, but it works out the same way the male takes a new role in Negro life.
Yeah, now only in that point are they the same.
Only on that point.
That the male takes a new role. But the women in the movement are not relegated to an inferior role. That the relationships that are developing between men and women, for instance, we had it when my wife decided that she wanted to go to jail. She didn't actually go, but she did take part. I mean, she wasn't arrested, but she did decide that it wasn't enough for a man to just be taking part in the demonstrations, that she had some role to play here also.
Do you have children?
Yeah, three. Mm-hmm. This is the family over in the corner. Mm-hmm. And we are together cultivating a new family pattern, but not imitating anymore. Now, we're drawing very heavily on the little anthropology we know, and using the experience of other cultures, including and maybe mainly African culture, as at least a buffering point.
Could you be specific on that? Using what from?
Yeah,
Africa?
I don't know.
For instance,
my wife's read Sex and Temperament, Margaret Mead stuff, and Jomo Kenyatta's Facing Mount Kenya on patterns of family life. She's had some anthropology also, so that whenever it comes time to face a situation, we're not really able anymore to accept what we feel to be a 19th century Western European notion of family life. Now, we really don't know what we're experimenting, what we've got. But rather than trying to mold our family into the typical patterns that it's expected a man to go out and do the work and a woman to raise the children, if she happens to get an education, she still uses her education to raise children. Now, my wife right now is teaching school, I guess I'm not ready to talk about this.
All right. All right.
Mainly because I just don't have it firmly enough in my mind.
Let's talk about something else. Let me give you a quote from Richard Wright on Africa,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which you may know already. Mm-hmm. On his visit to Africa, am I African? Had some of my ancestors sold their relatives to white men? And he found the belief in magic are not confined to the uneducated. The general culture uncongenial. I'm quoting, I found the African an oblique, hard to know man who seems to take a childish pride in trying to create a sense of bewilderment in the mind of strangers. Mm-hmm. I found the African almost invariably underestimating the person with whom he was dealing. Too much confidence in an evasive reply. And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Universal suspicion, distrust, inferiority in politics.
Mm-hmm.
This is the shock of acquiring the African history, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's some shock involved in it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that we decided too that we were not Africans.
Did you go there?
No, I haven't. But. Many of our friendships in college and in seminary were with Africans. And while there is a kinship, I think that we are, or I am, ready to accept the role of being a sort of a bridge person between Africa and the West, and that we almost don't belong anywhere, but we do, but we can relate anywhere. I mean, we can relate everywhere. I guess is the that I don't really feel, you know, completely accepted and at home here. And I know that I wouldn't be. This is one of the things that helped us decide not to go to Africa as missionaries in any sense. That we realized we wouldn't be really accepted as Africans, and that that our role and our place was, in a sense, in America. You know, that and there's no. I think Richard Wright was trying to almost escape from being an American to a certain extent. And I think we learned a little from that.
And he was shocked not to be accepted there. So it was a real shock to him because he expected something else.
And so we profited by that experience. In fact, Baldwin's experience of running to Europe and trying to escape, we experienced a little bit in a summer. And I think pretty much decided that, well, you were accepted in Paris, maybe. The Algerians weren't, so you just as well go back and fight your problem, and that America is maybe the place where the world will learn to live as one, that that we have every strain and tradition here, and that that by fighting out the personal as well as the political issues that keep men apart in America. We may be building the kinds of bridges that will enable people in the rest of the world to live together.
There's something about the problem of defining the Negro in America, which has taken one manifestation in the rewriting of Negro history.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know something about that. I don't mean merely American Negro history, but the Negro history outside. Or, let me read you a little passage. The whole tendency of Negro history, not as history, but as used as propaganda, is to encourage the average Negro to escape reality. The actual achievements and the actual failures of the present. Although the movement consciously tends to build race pride, it may also cause, unconsciously, the recognition that group pride may be built partly on a delusion and therefore results in a devaluation of the Negroes by themselves for being forced to resort to a self-deception. This is from Arnold Rose, Myrdal's collaborator.
Yeah.
I had to read a long passage, maybe it isn't all coming over.
Well, I don't know whether I got it exactly, but I think that my immediate reaction was that I think that there is something in Negro history.
Clearly,
to
there,
be
clearly
proud
there is.
Of. Yeah.
Nobody's arguing that.
And well, for instance, this was part of my self-discovery too, that nobody told me about Reconstruction. Nobody even introduced me to Du Bois until I was grown. And that there was a conscious effort in American history to devaluate whatever contribution the Negro has made. And this is a this is because they don't appreciate, we tend to have a kind of intellectual aristocracy in among our historians anyway. The contributions of masses of people, of laboring people, of slave labor even, to the whole economy and American structure, if you even talk about or think about, you're a communist. Now, I think that that as I've tried to use Negro history, it probably has been as propaganda. Because I never knew any Negro that really thought for himself. Nobody ever told me the influence that Frederick Douglass may have had on Lincoln, for instance, or on the whole period of the whole abolitionist period. And I think these are things that that we are using to try to let Negroes know that they are not completely without roots and heritage and connection.
Let's say all history works to, in one way or another, to condition our activities in the present and our feelings about the present. I don't think Rose, on the record, would be interested in devaluating the Negro contribution. Mm-hmm. As far, I don't know him, but I assume I take it as face value. But take a book like Africa's Slave Revolts. Mm-hmm. You know that book?
I haven't read it, but I've looked at it.
Well, it's something 200-odd revolts there.
This is a book I didn't get until a year or so ago.
And now some critics of the book will say there are only three are revolts. This is an attempt to inflate something. You find individuals or Tutsi people in desperate personal rebellion, but no organized revolts, except the three famous ones. And you find not of scares, but not the real thing, and not the organized revolt. But this is a case of an inflated piece of history, which does damage by its inflation, and actually does not do the Negro some of the credit he deserves.
The problem there, though, is that no Negroes have read Aptheker. I don't know. I can count on my hands the people who have really, we even know who he is or that he exists, that I know.
Now, why is that? Now, you have a range of very selected acquaintances.
Yeah. One thing is they almost completely rejected their own heritage back in that period.
Even your own generation?
Yeah, very much so. Until, we're just beginning to read Du Bois, even.
Really?
Except when it's assigned by school. Now, Negroes generally have had no interest in their own history, I think, until, I'd say almost until 1960, as far as except the few people that have really made a career of Negro history.
Like Woodson, you mean?
Yes, that's right.
Like that?
The masses of Negroes were consciously, I think, trying to assimilate. And they wanted to get as far away from their past. Because they wanted to become white. A friend of mine was saying that he sat down very diligently, learning every movement of every symphony, that he felt as though he had to know Shakespeare thoroughly and had to memorize quotations and things like this under the notion that when he had done this, he would be completely accepted in a white world.
This is the end of take one in the conversation with Mr. Andy Young. See tape two.